It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you're in the Wausau area tonight, you'll have the chance to hear from a longtime civil rights activist and one of the freedom riders of the early 1960s. She joins us with her story and what she hopes people today can learn from the civil rights movement. First, the fascination with who we are and where we come from has been part of humanity for a long time. There might be at least one person in your family actively researching your family tree, or someone who's given a try. Maybe that person is you. With the rise in popularity of genetic testing kits, genealogy has become a buzzword lately, but you don't have to test your DNA to piece together the puzzle of your past. There are many methods of research, and a lot of them are free, like talking with members of your family, digging through old photos, or looking at census records. Mary Dally Munsmeyer joins us now from our Milwaukee studio. She has over a decade of experience in genealogy research, family history narrative writing, and photo and document restoration. She's the founder of Cerebral Genealogy and a member of the National Genealogical Society. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're going to spend a lot of time on the how of genealogy, but talk a little bit about why. Why do we get so hooked on our family trees?
Well, that's a pretty broad topic. But for most people, it's to make a connection with their family in a long distance form, so back in time. Some people feel disconnected from their extended family, especially in our more mobile society where we don't really kind of gather in one geographic space anymore. So genealogy research can really bring you back into history and make it clearer how your ancestors lived and why they migrated or immigrated or just in general how they lived their lives, which gives us a personal connection to our ancestors.
I know part of your focus is kind of coming up with narratives and the story. So it's not just about collecting the names and dates on our family tree, but really trying to figure out the stories of the people who came before us, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I personally like to do narratives because it helps people tie together the historical context of when their ancestors lived, which can be drawn absolutely from the documentation. But in order to make sense of it, historical context is necessary. So understanding that maybe your ancestors came over during a period of war or after a war, and so they're economic refugees or political refugees, or they're just looking for more opportunity in another country. So understanding historical context helps to frame the story of your ancestors and give it more oomph, basically, but also a clearer path into the past.
Do you see all these DNA testing things, the genetic testing things, getting more people in the door, getting more people interested in genealogy?
I think it does. DNA is just one tool in the larger toolkit for genealogy research. And as you said at the beginning of this segment, it is absolutely not necessary to do DNA testing. A lot of people feel like they have to do it. That's just simply not true because the foundation of genealogy research is really the documentation. You want to follow the paper trail. And DNA in and of itself doesn't give you the answers to why, which is the the biggest reason that people want to study their family genealogy.
We're talking to Mary Dally Munsmeyer. She's a genealogist. She's the founder of Cerebral Genealogy. She's based in Milwaukee. We're going to get some advice now on how to do it, how to get started. And Mary, for somebody out there who's thinking, yeah, this sounds fun. I'd like to check this out. I have no clue where to begin. Where would you steer them?
Okay, so you absolutely do want to start with what you have and what you already know. And in a lot of cases, that means starting with yourself. And you can do that by thinking, you know, gathering all the documents of your own life and kind of tracking as you go through time. It's good practice to do that. So when you're studying other people, you have a better idea of what kind of information you're looking for to fill in the blanks of their lives. So then you just want to go the next level up. For most of us, that means our parents. If we're lucky enough to have our grandparents still alive, they can be, you know, an invaluable source of information. Many people start genealogy a little bit later in their lives. Although I have noticed more of an interest by younger people, and by younger, I mean in their 30s or 40s. So some of those people might be lucky enough to have their grandparents alive. But you do want to start with what you already have and what you already know. And be aware that we don't always know exactly all the details of even our parents' lives. We don't usually sit around and talk about what happened when you were in fifth grade, or where did you go to high school, and that kind of a thing.
Now, I've got a dad and an uncle who've done a lot of genealogy in our family, and they're very organized, and they end up with just reams and reams of information.
Sure.
I, myself, if I were to do this, I'm super disorganized. What would you say to someone getting started? What kind of systems can they put in place to make sure that they don't just get overwhelmed with this mass of material?
Right. So organization is key to this kind of research, and really for any kind of research. So where you want to start, I like to start with a family index. And this means that you're creating a document that is focused on one family. And the main information that you're putting in is for the father and the mother, or whoever the parents happen to be. And then who their children are, who their parents are, who their siblings are, and then connect those documents together. But move backwards in an orderly fashion. In terms of, this kind of talk can get a little wonky, but in terms of making folders and separating out the information, that's really important. The other thing that, in terms of organization, is to source your documents. Source where you got it, the repository you got it from, what kind of a document it is, and extract all the information that you can out of it.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is on the line in Milwaukee. Marcus, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. So I was also wondering this a couple of years ago, what a good starting point would be. And I sat down with a handheld tape recorder and the oldest living members of my family and a family tree that was in a family Bible. And so they explained to me about my great-grandfather who had passed away before I was born. And I now have an audio recording of their memories. And my grandma, unfortunately, she now has Alzheimer's, and so her memory has become quite spotty. But I've been able to go back with those tapes and go to my dad and my aunt, who's a sister, and, you know, kind of flesh out some of these stories. And since I have tapes, we can always go back and revisit it. And I found it a great way to start just from the immediate family tree.
And Marcus, did you feel like just the fact of doing this, sitting down with a tape, brought you closer to your older family members you talked to?
Yeah, it was a fantastic bonding experience. And, you know, heard some funny stories that, you know, now I wouldn't even be able to hear. Not necessarily that I'll tell my kids at this point. They're going to have to wait until they're at least 18. But, you know, interesting family lore and you know, nothing sinister, just, you know, drunken incidents and camping and so on and so forth.
Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that. Mary's sitting down and not just chatting and taking notes, but maybe even making a recording with relatives.
Absolutely. I really recommend that you record it, as long as everybody knows that you're doing that and it doesn't make people too uncomfortable. Once you start getting in the flow of conversation, people should forget that they're being recorded, especially with smartphones right now. The audio recording quality is very good. And oftentimes people don't notice that you're recording after a while. And they start to loosen up and tell you, you know, maybe some scandalous stories like Marcus's family did. And those are great stories for flavor, definitely.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Mary Dally Munzmeyer, member of the Association of Professional Genealogists and the National Genealogical Society. She's the founder of Cerebral Genealogy and is based in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you talked to family members about your family history? Did you learn something that surprised you? Have you dug into your genealogy collecting documents? Have you run into some dead ends along the way? Call in with your experiences or questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about genealogy with Mary Dally Munzmeyer. She's joining us from our Milwaukee studio. She's an expert in genealogical research, family history, narrative writing, and photo and document restoration. She's the founder of Cerebral Genealogy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1234. Tell us about your experiences trying to track your own family tree or call in with your questions for our guest. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Alice is with us in Madison. Alice, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been trying to follow my paternal side of the family several times, and I've always run into many obstacles and would like to know where I could begin. And this is because I never met my paternal grandfather. He was divorced from my paternal grandmother when my father was very young. And in fact, my father actually changed his name because of it. So I don't know his actual birth name. And to add to that, there was a misspelling of the last name somewhere down the line, and I don't know when. So it's been really hard to even pick up the beginning threads on my father's side, and I just wonder if you have any suggestions.
Alice, thanks a lot for the call. So a particular question there, but a pretty common experience, right, Mary, where there's a name change or different spellings of a name over time.
Yeah, that actually is pretty common, especially in cases of divorce where, the children actually either adopt their mother's name, the maiden name of their mother, or change it entirely. The one thing that I would ask of the caller is, does she have the original birth certificate? Her father's original birth certificate should have his birth father's name on it. It depends on whether, you know, when he was born, what kind of access she could get. But she really needs to, that would be the first document that I would suggest that would give her the best clues to start her journey on her paternal ancestry. That would be the best document to get. So she needs to, if she knows where her father was born, she needs to contact the Register of Deeds of that county, or she can contact, if he was born in Wisconsin, the state health department would have that record. She would have to prove her descendancy if it was under a certain time period. But if she has her own birth record, that could go through. But that would be the first document I would ask her to find.
Do you need to know? Good luck, Alice, with that. Do you need to know a birth year or a birth date to be able to track that down?
They do. They do. It just makes it faster and easier for them to find it. If she does not know her father's birth date, that's going to make it a little bit more difficult. She might be able to find him in an index and give them, I think he was born on this date. This is not a free service. You're going to have to pay for it. And since I've started, which was back in 2004, the costs for that have gone up. But at the same time, that's an invaluable document that can start you on your way.
Alice, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Chuck on Facebook who writes, a great deal of interesting information can be found in online newspaper archives, especially of small-town newspapers. One of the things I pay attention to is information on health. For example, a story on the 90th birthday party of one of my ancestors mentioned that she was still running up and down stairs and had a great memory. Yeah, that I've seen some of those old newspaper articles, and they do sometimes have a flair for those little details.
Absolutely. Small newspapers, really had a florid way of writing. And especially, the further you go back in time, the more kind of lurid details they may give you. If you can find things online, like newspapers.com has that, you can connect through that free through BadgerLink. So if you go to the public library, you can use your card to get into BadgerLink and look at that for free, as well as Ancestry.com. They've added more newspaper items. But sometimes the older, smaller towns, you have to go to the library itself in the town that it's in. But you can access a lot of things online.
I want to throw a couple challenges at you that different groups of people might have. African Americans in the United States sometimes hit a wall, especially if they get back to days of slavery. What are some of the resources out there that might be available to help overcome some of those obstacles?
Yeah, African Americans, back to a certain point, do have difficulty zeroing in on the individuals in their ancestry. Of course, in the 1870 census, that's when you start to see African Americans who are then free, by that time freed, if they were slaves, they begin to be named in the 1870 census. And prior to that, they may not even be in the census, but rather listed, sadly, as property with no names. So the what often happened with slaves is that their slaveholder gave them their last name. So what you want to do, in the census at least, is to try to make a connection between the 1870 census, this is getting very specific, and previous censuses, and then try to make a connection there. That is, it's a difficult process. It might be something that you want to hire a professional to do, just because it's very time-consuming. But it's very rewarding if you can find that information.
Talking to Mary Daly Munzmeyer about genealogy. She's the founder of Cerebral Genealogy, based in Milwaukee. You can join in with your questions about tracking your own family tree or maybe your experiences. 800-642-1234 is the number, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mary, one thing that's come up on my Polish side of my family is, after you go back a couple generations, you're looking back at the old country, and a lot of times that country, those borders may change from year to year. It might be Poland at one point, Austria-Hungary, Russia, Prussia, whatever. What happens? What are some advice when people start to look at look outside the United States for genealogical research?
Right. So in the past couple of years, Ancestry and FamilySearch.org, which FamilySearch is a free online service, they have added a lot more church records. For Europe, in particular for Germany. And you and I have something in common there. My paternal grandparents came from West Prussia, which is now a part of Poland. That can be a little bit tricky when you're talking about border changes, country border changes. But in terms of, in the example of Germany, they have those records. They did manage to save those records, and those are now held in Berlin. Many of those church records can be, as I said, found on Ancestry or FamilySearch, but it's not the entire amount of records. So that can be tricky. You're also looking at foreign language challenges, which you don't have to know exactly how, you know, be fluent in reading a particular language. You do have to know how to recognize people's names and have some idea of how they're related in the document.
Let's go to another caller now. Jen is with us in Washburn. Jen, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jen?
So I had a question. I've been doing some genealogy study. I've been tracking my matrilineal line, my mother's mother's line, and I've followed it back to around 1800 when my mother's family moved from, I believe, Pennsylvania to Ontario, Canada. And I was just wondering if at that time there was any sort of documentation when people moved from the U.S. to Canada or vice versa.
Jen, thanks a lot for the call. Mary, crossing back and forth over the Canadian border, how can we track that?
Well, that's an interesting point. There was no hard border until, and the exact year is not coming to me at the moment, but there was no hard border for many, many decades between Canada and the United States. So you can look at shipping passenger manifests or cruise ship manifests who sometimes took on passengers that traveled between Canada and the United States. You're not going to find immigration or naturalization until you reach the 1800s, at least the 1800s. I believe it's after 1860. So going beyond that, in terms of finding migration information, it may be difficult. But you do want to look at ships, at trains, train travel, although trains weren't really a thing then, before the 1800s. So ships would be your best bet.
Jen, thanks for the call. We'll go to Linda now in Milton. Linda, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about?
I was wondering if you knew anything about GEDmatch. Is
it
a reliable source to use, or is it, it's GEDmatch.com?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, GEDmatch is actually, it's a very useful service for DNA, and you can download, say, if you took a DNA test through Ancestry or 23andMe, you can transfer that data into GEDmatch, and they do have a very large database, and so they're bringing in data from their own, from Ancestry, from, like I said, 23andMe, and from other DNA sources. It is reliable. It is secure. So it's something worth looking into.
Thanks a lot for the call, Linda. Time, I think, for another caller. Paul is with us in Menominee. Paul, hi.
Hi there. It's amazing what you can come up with. One of my relatives spent a lot of time and found that my family, my mother's side of the family, came over in 1630, but they were also related in part of the English noblemen who had conquered England in 1066. And they were friends with William the Conqueror. And so it's amazing what people can dig out if they study it.
Paul, thanks. Some of my non-Polish ancestors might have worked for your relative. They were some of the peasant dudes, as far as we can tell. That's the kind of story we might come across, Mary. Briefly, as we wrap up, this could be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so doing genealogy research yourself is very fulfilling. It is a lot of fun. It does take a lot of patience and a lot of perseverance and kind of opening your mind up to where you could find documentation and what kind of historical context your ancestors lived in. So I recommend it to everybody, but if you hit a wall, you should try and contact a professional who specializes in what you're looking for.
Mary, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you so much.
That's Mary Dally Munzmeyer. She's the founder of Cerebral Genealogy and a member of the National Genealogical Society. She joined us with some advice on how and why we can do some genealogical detective work. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a civil rights activist, one of the famous freedom riders of the 1960s, who's speaking in Wausau tonight. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Freedom Riders were among the most high-profile demonstrators during the Civil Rights Movement, a group of white and black activists who faced violence and jail time as they worked to integrate busing in southern states in 1961. Our next guest was one of those Freedom Riders and has spent most of her life active in the Civil Rights Movement. Now she's sharing her experiences with people around the country. Joan Trumpauer Mulholland is the subject of the documentary An Ordinary Hero. She's speaking at Wausau East High School tonight at 6:30. That event is free and open to the public. She joins us now from our Wausau studio. Joan, welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, it would have been very easy for you to not do what you did, to stay home and watch events from afar. What led you to go and join the Freedom Riders?
Well, I was already involved in the sit-ins. And I think my decision to get to do something about race relations in the South, I'm a Southerner, came when I was 10 years old and snuck off with my playmate down in Oconee, Georgia, not that fancy resort. This is an old company logging town. And we walked through the black area, strictly forbidden for us. And when I saw the school for the black kids, just a shack, never been painted, no glass in the windows, just wooden shutters, no grass or playground equipment, one outhouse for everybody. So I say this unisex bathroom thing ain't nothing new. They had it there. And I knew out the other side of town was a post-World War II fancy brick building, fanciest building for miles around, still is, only now it's a senior citizens' place, and I knew this was not fair. This was not treating people the way we wanted to be treated, like we'd been taught in Sunday school. And I sort of knew, resolved, what have you, that when I could do something to make things what they closer to what they should be, I would seize the moment. And that came when I was in college and the sit-ins got started. The students that were involved in the sit-ins are the ones that kept the Freedom Rides going after the bus was burned in Anniston and folks were beaten in Montgomery and Birmingham. Gandhi and nonviolence.
Talk a little more about your experiences as a Freedom Rider. What kind of reaction did you get from pro-segregationists?
Oh, they didn't like it. Well, they assumed you were a Yankee when they saw you down there in Mississippi, that you were that northern invasion. But the fact that the police officer, when I stepped out of the paddy wagon at the county jail, took my arm to help me down that big step out of the paddy wagon, saying, "We don't want anything to happen to you, chillin'." Now, he did realize that I was the dreaded Yankee and jerked back, but the fact that his first instinct was good gave me faith that things were going to work out.
Now, you're talking to students, and you've been talking to people ever since this, but you'll be talking to students in Wausau, maybe people around the same age as you were when you got involved in this. What kind of message are you hoping to bring to them?
The revolution isn't over. They need to find something that needs fixing that they believe in and to get out there and fix it nonviolently. If nonviolence was enough for Gandhi to free India, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka from the British Empire, it can certainly help take care of their problems.
Do you worry that you're talking to people who were born well after the events we're talking about, the Freedom Rides and the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s? Do you worry that we have too much distance to it? This is history now, not something that we think about as something that's still relevant in our daily lives?
Well, my generation took care of legal segregation. We still have lots of underlying racism, and we see this lack of respect for people of different cultures, different languages, different religions, different gender identification. We still have a problem, and we need, and it's all interrelated. So the younger generation, it's up to them to go take care of it now.
We're talking to Joan Trumpauer Mulholland, a 1960s civil rights activist, still a civil rights activist. She was one of the Freedom Riders, subject to the documentary An Ordinary Hero. She's speaking tonight at Wausau East High School at 6:30. That documentary, An Ordinary Hero, I know I've heard you have a trouble accepting the word hero when people use it about you.
Yes, because there were thousands and thousands and thousands, up to 70,000 other students across the South doing the same thing I was doing. It's just that my son happened to end up being a filmmaker, and he outed me. Tricked me into it, mind you. Lived up to his name Loki after the Norse god of mischief. But I was just one of thousands.
Are there people or movements or actions going on in the United States today that you see as heroic, maybe ordinary people doing something heroic?
Well, scattered around the country, there are people working against religious discrimination, there's still Black Lives Matter. They do. All lives matter. There are people working down near the Mexican border to help folks who are trying to escape terrorism, violence, poverty in their own countries, with families being separated and things. There's lots that needs to be done, yet and still.
As a Freedom Rider and probably some of the other activism that you did, you took, as you know, a physical risk, a risk of encountering violence, a legal risk. You were arrested, risks of losing connections with your family. How did you steel yourself to face that?
In the movement, we became family. I can still see old buddies from back in the day, and it's like hug time. It's like we haven't been separated that long. And, yeah, it could be physically dangerous, but, I mean, we're going to die in the end. Do we want to die trying to cross the street at rush hour, or do we want to die for something we believe in?
Do you think the same kinds of activism you were doing in the 60s are still powerful, effective today, or do you think new forms of protest, demonstration, activism are needed?
Well, there's always new things coming in, but I think a lot of what we did is still valid, particularly if you keep it nonviolent and put your body where your mouth is. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't even have cameras. We had to have dimes in our pocket to go find a payphone and make a phone call. So I'm glad there are new ways, new techniques, new things you can do. But we've got to be careful that we don't think signing an online petition is the same as activism.
You, of course, met with very angry reaction. Now people look back and think of the Freedom Riders very positively. People look back at Martin Luther King Jr. very positively. But when he was active, there were polls that showed a lot of people opposed what he was doing.
Assassinated, too,
right.
You know.
So when you look at people's reaction to activism on issues of race today and still similar divisions, what do you make of that?
The more things change, the more they stay the same. It's no big surprise. We just recognize discrimination and what have you more widely than we did. And it was black and white back then, just like the TVs. Now we can see it in all sorts of different colors. And I don't think we'll ever get completely over it, but we can get a lot better.
Now, there were some very concrete outcomes of the activism that you were a part of, you and, as you said, tens of thousands of others, with the end of a lot of legal forms of segregation. Looking where we are now, do you feel disappointed by a lack of progress, or do you feel still optimistic and hopeful?
I'm still optimistic. I mean, after all, where was the first elected black governor in the history of the entire United States? In Virginia. In Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy. I mean, if we could pull that off, there's hope for almost everything.
It's a good place to leave it. Joan, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, and carry it forward.
That's Joan Trumpauer Mulholland, longtime civil rights activist, one of the Freedom Riders of the early 1960s. She's speaking at Wausau East High School tonight at 6:30. That event is free and open to the public. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Senate voted today to terminate President Trump's national emergency declaration. The president announced the move last month, trying to get more funding for his border wall, promised in the presidential campaign. When he did, he also touched off a debate about the separation of powers and presidential overreach. Ultimately, 12 senators from his own party voted to overturn that declaration, setting up a likely veto. The emergency declaration also continues to face a number of legal challenges. Yesterday, Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call announced that Wisconsin will be joining one of those efforts. John Blakeman is the professor and department chair of the UW-Stevens Point Department of Political Science. John, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've had the U.S. House vote against the emergency declaration, and now just earlier this afternoon, the U.S. Senate with 12 Republicans joining Democrats. What do you make of the outcome of that vote today?
Well, certainly, in one sense, Congress has spoken with pretty clear majorities in both houses to disapprove President Trump's declaration of emergency. Neither house has enough votes, it looks like, to override a presidential veto, which is pretty much an assured thing at this point.
Right. The president tweeted a one-word tweet after that, veto, all caps,
yes.
And he followed it up with a little more explanation. Can you talk about what led some Republicans, maybe reluctantly, I don't know, to oppose their president on this issue?
Well, going into this morning, there were about five Republicans who had publicly declared their support for the resolution. And, you know, they're conservative constitutionalists in a sense that they do not want to give more power and authority to the executive branch, regardless of who's in the Oval Office. Between last night and the vote early this afternoon, there was a lot of political wrangling, it sounds like. But, you know, some of the usual political motivations for to vote against the president, like a senator might be up for re-election in 2020 or might fear the president's retaliation. Those don't necessarily seem to have panned out, and only Susan Collins from Maine, she's the only Republican up for re-election who voted against Trump, and Tom Tillis and Cory Gardner from Colorado, who were sort of sitting on the fence, looks like they decided at the last minute to declare their support for the National Emergency Declaration.
And it's kind of a tangled issue. There's the philosophical constitutional argument about the separation of powers here. And President Trump wanted to focus on the immigration issue and border security in particular. Is that did the Republicans who voted with the president side with that border security side of things?
Well, yeah, the Republicans who sided with the president clearly view this in terms of border security, no questions asked. I think the Republicans who voted against Trump probably do perceive the conflict definitely in terms of the separation of powers. You know, the 47 Democrats probably see the separation of powers issue, but it's also for them a major vote against the Trump administration.
President Trump, this is before the vote now. He took a question today about his criticism of Republicans who were going to vote against his declaration. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
I think it's bad for a Republican senator. I also think it's bad for a Democrat senator to vote against border security and to vote against the wall. I think if they vote that way, it's a very bad thing for them long into the future.
Let's talk about the political consequences then of voting against the president on this one. President Trump definitely made border security and the border wall a big issue in the 2018 midterm elections. Democrats did pretty well in the House. Is this something that is going to sway someone's future here?
Well, I think probably so. President Trump has shown that he is very good at rallying the Republican base. And that might explain why Senator Tillis and Senator Gardner sided with Trump at the very end. You know, for Susan Collins from Maine, her support in Maine is pretty secure, and it's unlikely that Trump could affect that too much. But yeah, I think President Trump's message was probably received by some Republican senators who were sitting on the fence, and they did not want to run the risk of getting primaried the next time they were up for re-election, which may be 2 years away or even 4 years away. So yeah, for sure.
We are talking about the president's emergency declaration, a vote earlier today in the Senate voted against that declaration. That's probably going to be vetoed now by the president. John Blakeman is with us, professor and department chair of the UW-Stevens Point Department of Political Science. Closer to home here, John, we have Governor Evers and Attorney General Call joining this multi-state lawsuit against the emergency declaration. There are other attorneys general around the country who have sided with it. Do you think that, assuming the president vetoes this so it stays in effect, do you think these legal challenges will be real trouble for this declaration?
Well, yeah, potentially so. I mean, you have to have litigation like this as a mechanism to get this kind of separation of powers dispute up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the attorneys general involved in this lawsuit, about 20 of them now, are basically doing what attorneys general have been doing for the past three decades, and that's using litigation to contest federal policy that they disagree with. But for if you look at all of the states involved in the lawsuit, many of them have a lot to lose economically, not only in terms of the loss of grant money to law enforcement agencies, but also the loss of jobs from military construction projects that might be closed because the Trump administration shifts money from construction to building the wall.
Is this one of those cases where it's going to go through the courts and then we'll have this sort of non-ruling where it says the states don't really have standing, so we're not going to rule on the merits of the case? Wisconsin, I don't think, has a lot in the game on this one. Are there enough states with that impact that there's going to be standing?
Yeah, probably so. I mean, yeah, it's certainly true that Wisconsin doesn't necessarily see the level of economic harm that, say, California or Colorado or the state of Virginia are going to suffer. And I would expect that lower federal judges would let the case proceed on standing grounds, mainly because of the economics involved. The Supreme Court, of course, is unpredictable. But this is exactly the kind of constitutional dispute that the Supreme Court tends to think that it should resolve. Because if it's not resolved at some point, we have a constitutional impasse that just is not good for our system of government.
Let's get to the core of the argument about whether or not we are in a state of emergency at the border. Supporters of that idea of the president's declaration say, yeah, we do have this pretty big number, a historically large number of people coming and trying to cross the border at points of entry, not at points of entry. Critics say, wait a minute, the president and Republicans controlled Congress and the White House for 2 years, didn't do anything. That's kind of a slow burn emergency, if anything. What do you think about the idea of this being a national emergency?
Well, yeah, we're always going to argue over the objective basis for Trump's declaration of the emergency. And certainly there's no question that border crossings are high, but others would argue that they are relatively low compared to what we've seen, say, 20 years prior. I would argue that the objective basis for Trump's declaration is probably going to fall by the wayside as we continue to argue over the separation of powers. And as litigation proceeds through the federal court system, the separation of powers issues are going to become much, much more focused, and the objective data focus of Trump's declaration is probably going to matter less and less as we go on.
And with the issue of separation of powers, has the president of the United States, so whichever president that might be, gotten more power over time? Has Congress ceded too much authority to the executive branch?
Oh, absolutely no question about that. And it's not just Congress ceding authority. It's the U.S. Supreme Court sort of reallocating authority to the executive branch, too. And certainly, since World War II, the power of the executive branch has grown almost exponentially. And, you know, it doesn't matter if the White House has transitioned from a Republican to a Democrat or Democrat to Republican. No incoming president is going to hand over a White House that has less power than when he came in. So it's just sort of the nature of the office where the power tends to grow. And it's also Congress and the judicial branch have been relatively reluctant to try to rein the president in.
Is that ever going to happen, reining a president in, given that there's going to be a substantial portion of Congress in the same party as the president?
Well, right. That's always a fair question. I actually would expect this case to be one of those sort of watershed constitutional disputes where the Supreme Court will most likely rein in the executive branch. But the impact that that has long term, you know, that's really unpredictable.
Right. And with the U.S. Supreme Court, as I understand it, there seems to be a reluctance to make a sharp turn. They might make a limited limit on the president, not a big limit.
Yeah, that's true. And historically, the Supreme Court would rather Congress and the president fight these issues out themselves, you know, because they are the two elected branches of government, and in that sense, they are the most accountable. So historically, the justices on the Supreme Court have often said, you know, you two branches go resolve this on your own. We'll sort of police the margins of the dispute, but this is really something for you all to work out.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That's John Blakeman, professor and department chair of the UW-Stevens Point Department of Political Science. He was with us to talk about a vote in the U.S. Senate today to terminate President Trump's declaration of a national emergency for border wall funding. That vote succeeded. The president on Twitter quickly threatened to veto that effort by Congress now. On top of that, Wisconsin, as of yesterday, has joined a multi-state lawsuit challenging the president's emergency declaration. By the way, Senator Ron Johnson voted on the side of the president on this one. Senator Tammy Baldwin voted with all the other Democrats against the president and his emergency declaration. Today is an unofficial holiday I'm liking more and more. Pi Day, because it's March 14th, 314, the first few digits of the number pie. Some pies showed up here. J. Carlisle Larson, you tried some of it, right?
I did try some of it. Our boss brought in a cranberry crumble cake, which was pie. That's the whole point. this morning, and I thought it was pretty good. We shared it with engineers. I am a big pie fan, but I'm terrible at making it.
Yeah, me too. And I can't make a good crust.
Nope,
I usually use a store-bought crust, and I don't do a top crust. Yeah, my pie repertoire is super limited. What's the most ambitious pie you've ever tried making?
I did once successfully make a lemon meringue pie.
Ooh,
for a friend's lemon-themed birthday, which is strange in its own, but it worked fine until the meringue basically separated from the pie.
Uh-oh.
And congealed on top. It still tasted good. It just looked like a nightmare.
I made some pretty good fruit pies. Again, no top on them. I once lost a bet to my dad as a kid. We were at a restaurant, and he said he was going to get lime pie, and I thought he was joking. Like, how do you make limes into pie? That's crazy talk. And then he, of course, ordered the key lime pie and got it, and I lost $1.
Oh,
I think it was 9. I mean, I don't know even where I got that money.
I also want to point out that that is the best pie.
Key lime?
Oh, yeah.
With whipped cream?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Strong opinion here. Like it. I'm a fan.
I offer you any pie, you're going to say key lime.
Yes.
Wow.
100%.
I'm a big raspberry pie guy.
Yeah.
Chocolate pies. Yeah, I like a lot
of those
pie.
Are fine.
All right. It's Pie Day. Celebrate in your own way with your own pie. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.